And I'm realizing that the thing that would have stopped me before was a temporary thing, but I was able to power through it.
Hello, and welcome to Salesforce Trails and Trials, where two Salesforce architects and special guests share their wins and woes so that you can learn with us.
In this episode, we learn about the power of the visual and UI design tools that support Lightning Design System. We learn a bit about second generation packaging and the benefits for non-ISVs like SI partners and admins and Salesforce users. We talk about mountain biking, outdoor, sports, tournaments, things that are exciting for middle-aged folks like us. And we talk a little bit about foster kids and foster care and all the inspiring people who are making a difference in kids' lives. Thanks for listening this week, and don't forget to subscribe and share with your friends. So, Eric.
Hey.
What a beautiful day today.
It is a beautiful day near me, too. We're about 500 miles apart from each other, but I'm glad to hear that you have good weather, too.
Yes, it is. It's been wonderful. I love the in-between seasons, you know?
Yeah.
It's just, I don't have a convertible anymore, but I always remember thinking about, you know, the transition from like, you know, for spring and for autumn was always like the best time to drive a convertible.
Yes, it is.
So nice.
A couple times. So I think about a bunch of things when spring happens. My brother went to school in upstate New York, and as soon as it hit 40 degrees, it was shorts weather. So depending on where you are in around the world, spring comes and it's either a little bit chilly still, but it doesn't matter because the sun's out. Or, you know, I've worn shorts and flip-flops for days here in California. And the other thing that comes to mind is my grandmother used to say in summer on the perfect nights, "Isn't the air just delicious?"
That's great.
And that phrase comes to mind when it's 81 degrees at night, or, you know, 79, it's somewhere in that area, and it's just perfect. So anyway, yeah, good weather.
Yes, no, I was actually out. I mean, I took my shoes off before we started here, because in this pandemic, right, I've been spending so much time without shoes. It's really right. Interesting. So now when I have to wear shoes all day, I just feel so constrained. It's funny. But I was at pickleball the other night at the park here, a place called Chatsworth Park South. And I was out there with my buddies, you know, and it was probably like 6:30, 7 o'clock, and the sun has just gone down behind the mountain.
Yeah.
And we're surrounded by all of this kind of West Valley, beautiful, mature oak trees. There's just a little breeze. It's a little cool coming off the mountain.
Perfect.
I was just like, guys, like, are we living the dream right now? Or what?
Yes.
You know, it's just, yeah, it's so good to stop and be grateful about those small things and not just let them pass. So that's great. I just think it's, it's beautiful and a lot to appreciate for sure.
Yeah, it is. It's that time of year. You got to soak it up.
Right. Absolutely. So let's talk about what we learned lately.
Sure. I was thinking about this week. I'm meeting with a customer. I'm doing some sort of webinars with them on what they do with their job, you know, how they use Salesforce and things like that. And one of the things we focused on was UI design tools that support the Lightning design system, or, you know, the Salesforce look and feel. For all my time at Salesforce, I've always been part of little research projects where, you know, our own R&D group wants to figure out what's the best UI for forecasting, or, I don't know, sales, whatever people are trying to do, log activities. And I've been part of these UX user experience and user interface research sessions. And what I learned this week was two things. The first is, as my customer put it, he's been building apps all wrong. Hmm. And the idea that he thought he knew what he was doing with Salesforce, and he's an MVP at my customer, within the Salesforce space. And his realization was, wow, UI mockup tools save so much time. Hmm. Mm-hmm. And make you so much more safely productive, meaning you won't go too far down the road, down the wrong path as a developer when the business doesn't understand your UI. So start using UI tools. And the other one was, there's a right way and a wrong way to use these mockups. And the wrong way is to build out the mockup and then explain it to the business. What you're supposed to do is build out the mockup and then say, so,
yeah,
what do you want to do when you see this screen?
Right.
I don't know. What are we doing today? You're forecasting. Oh, well, what happens if I click this button? I don't know. what do you want to happen when you click this button? And it reminds me so much of all the mockups, the UI sessions I've been through. And so for everybody else out there, we're using, at this one customer, they're using Avani, they're using Sketch, and they're using Figma. There's probably others, and they all have Lightning Design System support. And the often the viewer license is free, whereas the editor is the one you pay for. So you can really engage your whole audience to do this. So that's my learning this week, is it's not something I normally do. And I just say, go check out some UI design tools. If you're somebody building custom apps in Lightning, they say it will help you out from an actual customer's mouth.
Yes. So I've been into a few of those sessions at Dreamforce, right? So they bring you in, they give you a little gift card, and they kind of walk you through, you know, like, I think collaborative forecasting, the second iteration of that, right? Was I was part of that very early on. And I thought it was fascinating. And, you know, as part of the, we've used Sketch for that before, which works out really well. And I remember an example when I went and got my UX cert from Nielsen Norman. They did this exercise with us where they, and these are all people who, right, we're here getting certified, you know, like we are professionals.
You know Salesforce pretty well.
Who know Salesforce as well as knowing like the UX space, right? Like we're there, we know interface and at least something about design and know it's important. So they kind of just told us a couple phrases. They said something like, you know, draw something, I want to draw something with four corners and now connect the corners. I mean, it's really basic like that. So they people drew it out, right? And then they like had everybody hold up what they had, right? And you know, some people had long rectangles, short rectangles, squares, diamonds. You had all sorts of stuff, right?
And they were all correct.
And they were all correct according to the words. Exactly. And they said, this is the power of an image in that the words, everybody's interpreting it and kind of everybody wants to feel like they understand. And that bias pushes us to feel like, well, what I think is what they're saying, right? Whereas once it becomes a picture, now people can point at it and say, my thought was different than that, simply from a picture. Right. It was such a powerful exercise.
Yeah. I talk about that too, when just from an architecture perspective, when I'm talking with my other architects at work or with a customer, and I did it this week, when you hear something, draw a picture. You know, our systems connect to our APIs. We don't have external APIs, but when we need them, we generate a new one and we put it in the DMZ and whatever. That's where it started this week. And so I drew a picture and I sent it to my integration team. And I said, for the next call you have, this drawing is no doubt wrong, but make it right. Like this is the beginning. It's a Lucidchart chart. We can all share access and but just make a picture. Cause I've said before, like you can point to it. It becomes well adopted sometimes by the people on the other side of the phone, your customer, your partner, and you now have the same image and you're aligned. Or if you're not aligned, it gives somebody to point at and say, oh, this part's wrong. This part's wrong. This part's wrong. Okay. That's fine. I'd love to correct it, but I wouldn't have gotten that correction if we had just stayed aligned verbally. So yeah,
that's really a great point. Well, and just a final point on this too, that like one other benefit of you doing this is it keeps you out of vaporware of like just listening and providing no deliverable back to the client. And two, a natural evolution of customer projects is that like people enter and exit the project at the client site and even, you know, at the partner or whatever it might be, whoever might be serving them at Salesforce, people come and go and there's latency, you know, there's vacations, there's maternity leave, paternity leave. So the great thing about an image is that recall. So recall, when you describe something, they're like vaguely, but when you point to something and say, here's the topology, here's the UI, whatever it is that we were talking about before, they're like, I remember. Yes,
totally.
We're all on the same page. And the new people that come on board are like, yes, I understand. I'm accelerated. And now I can add value.
Yeah.
So valuable.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
And there is headwind to that. I went through an exercise with a management consulting company named MAP years ago. And we have I don't want to give away the session because they're really valuable sessions, but there's a little exercise at the end where you're doing a mock sales pitch to the CEO that we should acquire a business. And you basically have 5 minutes and you have to do whatever, right? And so you have a flip chart. And so everybody was like writing all these words on all of their flip charts. And I'm like, guys, we have 5 minutes. We are not going to even be able to read the words on one of these.
This is not a PowerPoint.
It's not a PowerPoint. Yes. Exactly. I was like, we need pictures, right? And they're like, I could just tell. They're like, dude, that sounds so elementary. Like they're going to laugh at us. Like we're going to leave, like we're school children. I'm like, I just need you to trust me. Right. And so it was like, all right. So we did the pictures and it's a contest. There's four teams and only one of us is going to win the pitch. right? So everybody in with all their words and their flip charts and all that. And we went in with our pictures and we pointed the picture and went on to point to the picture and we won. And everybody was just like, what? It was such a great exercise because there's a lot of pushback sometimes against using these kind of tools and thinking about simple lo-fi prototypes as being valuable because it looks elementary, it looks unfinished, it's not produced well, but it is so valuable and so worth the effort to internally sell in the business.
Yeah, absolutely. I could go on and on this one,
right?
But I think so we got to move on to you. What about you? What is your, what I learned lately?
Mine's a little more esoteric. I caught the AppExchange, ask me anything call around second generation packaging. And, packaging is not something that's really well known, I think, even in the Salesforce ecosystem. It's kind of like the behind the scenes element. And so anybody who's used an AppExchange product, right? If you download, DocuSign or Conga or any of those applications, you're using a package to install that into your org. So they're going through the packaging process to bring those features to you.
Right. DocuSign does that to package DocuSign. It. So the plumbing's already made. You can drop it into the org.
Absolutely. Right. So anything you install in the AppExchange generally is packaged. What I thought was cool is that there's a lot more capability opening up in second generation packaging. We've known it for some time, but it just continues to mature. And in this call, they went a lot behind the scenes, as far as what's going to be made possible. And it got me thinking about other uses for packages, right? For example, Salesforce partners or even Salesforce customers, they may not think about packaging as something that they should care about.
Right.
And so, some examples are, for example, I had a customer years ago that was a real estate company. And real estate has these really interesting requirements in that, the broker is a business and then the agents are kind of their own business. They're not employees of the brokerage necessarily. They're like independent contract. And so there's this compliance requirement around the contacts that come in. So like the contacts that they're kind of like secure and they can be seen by the brokerage. But if the brokerage partners with like another real estate developer, for example, they can't share those contacts with that real estate developer. Let's say like on a joint venture, they're going to build a hotel or a timeshare space, right? And so they had to solve this by how do we let them use our process and all of our tools in Salesforce, but protect all of our contacts from being shared with them? That'd be a really complex security model because they're going to have 3, 4, 5 of these different joint venture partners, right? So the solution was build a package. Take your internal configuration inside your org that works for your agents and then build a package and install it into a new org that now keeps all the contacts secure.
Yep.
And now those agents can use all of your tools that have been installed, can now be upgraded and can be maintained. Even some analytics around what people are using and not using and load times, all that kind of stuff without having to share all the contacts. And second generation packaging just makes that even more robust because you can now have platinum, gold and silver packages, which you can kind of turn on and off and deliver to people. You can create feature sets. Like imagine if you're in a large enterprise and you're like, okay, we have this is the sales set or stream of features. And then we have the service stream of features. You can create packages to those so that people can manage that much more discreetly. And going back to your dependencies, as we talked about last episode, some of this stuff helps to make these more self-standing and not so coupled together, so that they can be developed independently as feature packages, even if you have no intention of going to the AppExchange.
Yeah, I've seen this most. I can think of 3 or 4 or 5 customers who have, their business model is like what you talk about. They're either doing customer service on behalf of another company. And so in their contract, it says they can't commingle company A's data with company B's data. So you're instantly looking at multiple Salesforce instances. Another customer does outsourced renewal sales. So, you take your whatever that your contracts that are renewing at the end of the year, you pass the low value ones, high volume ones over to this renewal company. They commit to delivering renewals at a lower rate compared to what your costs are for your salespeople. So they have an outsourced model for sales. They do the same thing. They then And then, so more than once, and also event planning. I worked with an event planning one time who had their intellectual property, the automation around, we want to give people a mobile app when they check in. We want to provide our client visibility into who's checked into the event. We want to let people know where they are. It was like, imagine if you're walking into Dreamforce and you're Mark Benioff or somebody, and you got to know when your high VIP contacts come in and where to meet them. And they want to deliver that. The way to do that is package it. And every time you have a client that needs one of your events, you then just open up a new org, deploy your package, and operate and run that project for 2 months, a month, a week, whatever. And then, I don't know, export the data, give it back to your client. But that, I've seen that a lot. And the packaging is, you're right, it's not something most people need to learn. But if you ever find a case where, gosh, it'd be really good if we had more than one instance, but I don't want to manage them separately. If you put your stuff in a package, what you didn't mention yet, which I don't think you did, was the publisher of the package can upgrade that package and push the upgrades out to 1, 2, 5, 100 different sales instances or more at once. And you only have to maintain that package in one place.
Yes,
that's what's really cool.
It is super cool. And with second generation packaging, you can actually do deletions. You know, you can remove fields. You can, you can do what are called destructive changes. You can remove things with, you know, with permission. So it offers a lot more capability. And so well done to the Salesforce team. And I think it's, you know, for partners and for, you know, for admins and others out there, it's really useful to look at packaging because, as you mentioned, it is a great way to solve some really unique challenges in the ecosystem. Yeah. Awesome. So let's talk about one small thing that might have a big consequence. And I think this week we're talking about, what if I just change my data type of a field, right?
Sure.
Now, this is a little hidden, right? So if you go into, you go into a text field and you click edit, that's where you can change the label and all that. We talked about that last episode.
Yep.
But at the top, there's a little button on several of the fields that say change data type. So I could change my lookup to a master detail, for example, or I could change my text field to an auto number field, or my auto number field to a text field, or text field 255 characters to 100 characters. I guess that's not really changing the data type per se, but what are some things you can think of here? Some risks, some gotchas?
Yeah. So on the one hand, I know when I'm mocking something up quickly, I do this all the time. I'll think initially, oh, I need this field. And then I realize, shoot, it's the wrong field. In particular, I'll create a lookup field and I'll need it to be a master detail. One of the things you get with master detail is formula fields can total up the number of, you know, records or a particular value on those records when there is a master detail child record hooked to a parent record. So sometimes you really want that. And I've gone through and I've set up my demo and I've populated my data and I realize, shoot, I can't do what I want to do because it's not master detail. And then I go to change it and it goes, and it says, no, 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 you can't change this because you haven't populated every other instance of that child record with a parent record. So there's, I know that there's some blocking or some safety rules, some guardrails in there before you change a field. That's one thing that happens. What were you thinking about?
Well, one thing I've seen is where, for example, when you change a, some people start like the standard name field. So the standard name field is on every record, right? Yeah. And by default, this, when you create a custom object, for example, the standard name field is always open text, right? And it's not unique. So I could have like five records that all have the same name, right? So when I go to search, just like I can with contacts, right? I can create 50 John Kleins.
Sure.
It doesn't care.
Same with opportunities.
Same with opportunity. It just doesn't care, right? So a standard custom object, let's call it payments, right?
Yep.
And I could have the name field on that payment record be payment. And so when I search for payment, it just has, or if I search for a dollar amount, it just has payment, 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 right? Not super useful.
Yeah.
Now, that's the default. So let's say I see that and I realize it. Oh, I need to go back and I need to make my name field an auto number field. So I'm going to go, I'm going to edit that field. I'm going to change the data type. I'm going to switch to auto number. And it's going to say, I can't do that unless you clear out all the data, right? You got to make all the data blank. So it's kind of the opposite of the use case you gave, right? I got to clear out all the data. And then it'll ask me, all right, I think it'll ask me when I know it asked me when I add a new one, do I want to populate historical records? I'm not sure if it does that. I think it does that when I do it and changing it, but either way, I got to remove all the data and then add the auto number back, and it'll then populate all those fields.
Mm-hmm.
There's one other instance I can't think of right now that you could lose data. Oh, here's one. Yes. So let's say, for example, I change a field from a text area field mm-hmm. to a mm-hmm. text field.
Yep.
Right. It's going to warn me and say, hey, right, I'm going to go ahead and reduce this field down. If there's data that's longer or more characters than will allow, it will be removed.
We're just going to chop it off.
We're going to chop it off.
Yep.
Yeah. Hope it's not important to you.
Yeah. That's one of those things where you want to check again using some tool or run a report and know what you're getting into, because there is no recovery. When you do something like that, there's some updates in Salesforce where there's no undo. Truncation, I hope you did a backup first. By the way, public service announcements, do your backups, do weekly data exports,
yes.
Automate your backups, get a backup tool, own backup. There's a bunch of them on AppExchange.
GearSet does data backups.
Yeah. Do weekly backups. I mean, just do one before you're about to do an admin change where there's some data deletion. Mm-hmm. We take care of backups, but the backups that we make at Salesforce are in case we make mistakes. If you make a mistake as an admin, we don't have a good practical way to go back and find just your org's data mm-hmm. and just the table you messed up mm-hmm. and put it back. Mm-hmm. So make sure you do your backups, use that weekly data export, and you know, you'll be happy you did.
No, it's good. Absolutely. Another example with your lookup to master detail. So let's mm-hmm. say I'm used to when you create a lookup record, right? You have this option that says, well, what should I do when someone deletes the parent? Mm-hmm. You know, should I block it?
Yep.
Right? Should I just blank out this value? That's usually what people do, is they blank out the value, right? So it just, the parent goes and the child stays. Right. Well, let's say you switch that and nobody knew. You switch that to a master detail relationship. Mm-hmm. And now people are used to being able to delete the parent and have the mm-hmm. children remain. Well, now it's master detail. So now the child records get deleted with a parent when you've switched it to master detail. So all of a sudden people might not realize, but quietly all those child records are also getting deleted now.
Yep.
Because they're deleting
totally
the parents.
True. And now you did this last week, which is great. You're getting into what are the user implications, mm-hmm. not just the data implications, but if the users are used to a certain behavior mm-hmm. and you change in particular master detail or look up to master detail or look vice versa, you know, people might be doing what they didn't mean to do. And it's definitely something you got to think about. It's a good point. The other one that people do all the time is that you will need to change your, in fact, look at doing it now in a sandbox. But if you are using a customer number or a year field and it's a number and you're seeing extra commas in there, it's because it's a number and you need to change that field to be a text field. And that way the year 2020 won't be 2,00,020. It's just something that novice, you know, new people to Salesforce always do. Mm-hmm. It's a number. Well, kinda. You don't want it to treat it like a number though. So
yes,
that's one where I found myself before changing data types.
It's very true. And I've seen the same thing for currency where people will use number instead of currency. And you're like, why do some numbers have a dollar sign and some don't, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or some change to the currency that I select and others don't. And so you're exactly right. Number and currency, right? The rule of thumb is if there's math involved, use a number or use currency. If there's no math involved, use text.
Yeah. Cool.
Very good.
That's a good one.
That's a good segment.
I think we thoroughly covered that one.
Right. Well, good. So let's talk about what you're excited about.
How about, I have grown up in California. I bought my first mountain bike when I was 14. Well, maybe before that, can't remember. And I've been a casual mountain biker. And all I can say is lately, I've just been inspired. I think it was a random encounter at a restaurant with another dad in my town. And we just got to talking and he lives in the neighborhood I live in. He says, hey, have you been mountain biking? Because there's some trails near my house. And I said, you know, I was thinking about it, but you know, I don't know, I went out for a ride and I told him I did that much, but I hadn't done these big trails out in like the state park that's near my house. And so this, you know, 5-minute conversation with him inspired me to go check out the trail he told me about. And I did it and I realized, man, I am out of shape. I'm out of shape, but it was very steep. There were 4 steep parts where I was like, nope, not going to do it. I made it through. It was a 7-mile loop. About 2 miles of it was in the state park. And then the rest was just on little roads. And I've just gotten inspired to kind of go out more 2-3 times a week and just do loops in my neighborhood with some hills and get more in shape and figure out how to figure out what gear I should be in. Cause I'm thinking I might do that more. So I guess, you know, I'm starting to look for mountain biking magazines and, you know, videos on gear, mountain biking theory on YouTube, believe it or not, there are such things. Mm-hmm. So anyways, that's my new,
yeah,
the new thing I'm excited about.
I can't wait to hear all the new terminology, you know, when you talk about like, well, what's single track and, you know, what do you like, uphill or downhill? And do you lock out?
Oh my God. Yeah. There's so much where I'm just like, there's a whole vocabulary that I don't know yet.
Oh, I love it. That is wonderful. Yeah. And it sounds like your daughter may have been a little inspiration here. No?
Well,
you know, you gave a biking story 2 episodes ago that, like, you know, that really inspired you just in the neighborhood.
It did. So. We did actually start going out. The weather started getting good and we started going out for a neighborhood bike ride with the kids. And she got a new bike that she'd grown out of her old one. And I think it was something like, you know, I need to find ways to do something besides sit on my butt and like stare at a Zoom screen. And mountain biking is a good way to just get out, and there's speed and there's wilderness and, you know, practicality of getting somewhere. And today I rode down to the park with my fishing gear just to kind of get it out and try it. And then I rode home. So, you know, that's nice. What my geek out is today.
Oh, I love it. I love it. So mine also is on the athletic front. So definitely appreciating the spring here. And so, first of all, you know, as a 44-year-old, I love the idea. You know, I've been a volleyball player my whole life, you know, since
I've been playing volleyball about twice a year since sixth grade myself.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right. I profess it every day. I'm a professional. You know?
Yes.
And so, you know, now I'm playing with 20-year-olds and it's a little tougher for me to stay as kind of dominant as I like to be. Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so transitioning to pickleball has been helpful because it leverages a lot of the volleyball skills, especially the overhead smash.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very accessible, right, to someone that's 44. So we, you know, a buddy of mine, we've been playing regularly I've only been playing for like 6 months, but we entered our first tournament. So it's coming up on May 31st. You know, we're going to compete against other people, which again, I'm at 44. I haven't competed in anything sports related since college. Right.
Yes.
So the idea of this is super fun. And so, you know, that brings in the whole thing about strategy, like you're talking about, right? So thinking about like mindset and looking for, you know, all of the ways to maximize your opportunities against your opponent, to maximize the weather, to think about how you keep yourself calm and try and avoid unforced errors. There's so much applicable to life in that, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I think about what I learn about, you know, taking a breath before I serve. I'm like, I need to do that with my kids, you know?
Yes.
Take a breath before I respond. So I love that aspect that there's so much about sports that is applicable to life. Mm-hmm. And so I also heard about, you know, I'm also like, I love data. So I also heard about this thing called an error board. So it's essentially this little kind of, it's a thing that looks like a court. And you have just these kind of different stacks of magnets. You know, one of the magnets is errors, one of the magnets is drives, one of the magnets is like winners, whatever it might be. And so you just have somebody who sits in a chair and they watch the game and they're just like,
yeah, they're keeping your stats.
They're just keeping your stats, right? And then you take the error board afterwards and you just count it up. You're like, you know, there's the errors, there's the winners, you know,
yeah.
and suddenly the guy we hired a couple coaches, of course, mm-hmm. to kind of help us. One's kind of a skills coach, and the other one's kind of a mindset strategy coach. And he was highlighting, he's like, you know, sometimes you find that, you know, for every forehand or for every, every forehand success, you have 5 forehand errors. And so you really change your mindset to say, look, your footwork needs to be where you are emphasizing your backhand, right? Where you are coming at the ball at your backhand side, and you change your whole thought process around how you're going to go and to, you know, field that ball because of your error profile. So
because of your profile. Yeah.
Yeah. It's my profile, right? I need to certainly work on the skills, but while you're building the skills, you have to focus on what you have and leveraging, right, what you have the best you can. And so it's an interesting game because when you first start, probably even like maybe with mountain biking, you have this, at least when I did, right, this exhilaration about going fast and hard, right? But you can't go for very long if you're doing that constantly. And pickleball is the same way. Like people get in and they just hit it really hard and they want to drive the ball like tennis. And then suddenly, as you continue to grow, you've realized that's not actually the game, you know, like that's possible, but the game is much more about, you know, placing the ball over pacing the ball, you know, and that's where the fun is, because now it's in those intricacies, right? It's in that just a couple inches here and there that, you know, that these victories are won, which makes it,
I think that's the majority of people, you know, that we can't all be Venus Williams or Ivan Lendl or, you know, pick your tennis star,
your pro, right?
But the long game, you know, there's always, if you're up against Venus Williams, who has amazing endurance and strength and accuracy, you know, there's a reason that she's well seated and you're not. But if you're just, you know, at your local court, pickup court, whatever, the one who's going to win, it's almost like that story of the rabbit and the hare, you know, as long as the tortoise is like, keep on walking, keep on hitting, keep, you know, just keep going,
just stay in it.
Yeah. I was finding with mountain biking, totally burned out fast on my ride. And now I'm actually, for the first time in my life, paying attention to, yes, I've always noticed when my thighs feel like they're burning, but then I'm noticing that 15 seconds later, my thighs are not burning anymore. And I'm realizing that the thing that would have stopped me before was a temporary thing. But I was able to power through it. And so it's encouraging when you see your body respond. Thankfully, our bodies are still young enough to be responding. But I was able to power through it.
It's encouraging. Keep going.
And you're probably pacing a little bit. You know, you're making some adjustments.
Thankfully, our bodies are still young enough to be
responding. And that is something to be excited about, because all that, right, yields longevity. I mean, you know, I had two 20,000 step days this week, right? And it's like, man, my average,
including pickleball steps,
yeah, they're all pickleball steps for the most part, but yeah, I mean, I used to have days where I get 3,000, you know.
Yeah.
And I just think about how important that is in life, and especially right now, just with so many things being closed, and so important to find something outside. Well, good.
Yeah, well, speaking of outside,
my
noteworthy thing that's inspiring us is outside. Today we have a light work day. It's the beginning of the fiscal quarter, and so a lot of my teams are just kind of taking a wellness day, we call it. And so I had a call this morning that I had with my customer already booked. And aside from that, it's been a light day, and just going outside or taking my email outside or taking a meeting outside, psychologically, I feel like I get optimistic just by seeing sky. My comment is, we've talked about so many times today already on the call, spring weather, get outside. I was trying to think, what is my inspiring experience recently that gives me, you know, reason to move? And it has been the weather that makes me want to get outside and go do something. I found also, and this is obvious to anybody who's ever walked or is a photographer or a movie person, the golden hour, which is right before sunset, it's probably around 5-6 o'clock where I am right now, probably 6-7. Everything, the sun is low. It's probably that time you were talking about when we opened the show today, about that perfect air and the slight breeze, whatever. But when the light is low, that's the best time to go for a walk for me. It's not too hot. It's still daylight. Everything looks amazing because there's high contrast. There's orange light coming from the sun.
Yeah, you see all the things flying, you know, you see all the,
So anyways, get outside. That's my inspiring thing.
That's good. And for those who are listening, who are in areas, you know, I hear about, like, you know, the Portland and Seattle and, you know, the kind of, they're different seasons, right? I mean, we're spoiled here with our sunshine.
We just have earthquakes and fires in the fall.
Right. Right.
We're spoiled the moment.
Yeah, at the moment. But there's always a way, you know. There's little hats you can get that, like, have the light, right? But just find a way to get out and to, it's a good encouragement.
And just on that season topic, my brother lives in Boston and his wife is from Maine. My brother's obviously in California, and same as me. And what they do with their kids is, you know, there's winter camp and the kids go out with a camp counselor in, I don't know, 25 degrees Fahrenheit weather. It's snowy outside. Maybe it's 15. And they've got their, you know, gloves on and their hats and gloves and jackets. And they just have summer camp outside and they build an igloo or they sit around a little bench they made out of snow or go through the forest. And I was visiting other friends that live in Chicago a couple of years ago, and it was January. They had an ice skating rink next to them and it was freezing outside for me. It was like 12 degrees and they told the kids, okay, go outside and play hockey. And that's just, you know, for me, that sounds crazy, but yes, it's possible in every climate.
It's possible. It's awesome. I know. I think that somebody told me a story of a woman who, like, cuts holes in the ice and, like, shows people how to ice fish on YouTube. You know, she's got a channel that she just goes out there and, you know, takes her, like, great, more than 15 minutes of like really hard work to cut mm-hmm. through the, but when she does it, you know, she just enjoys, you know, catching the fish, and it's just a totally different experience. I just love the creativity that people have, you know, in these different environments. What's inspiring me right now is, I think, you know, we've talked before that I was a foster kid for 9 years, and I'm so grateful to my foster family that it was from 11 months old to 9 years mm-hmm. old. And they were so instrumental in making, you know, really forming who I am as a person today. I mean, I think about my foster dad, Fred. He was an entrepreneur in his own right. You know, he had an almond ranch, and he also was a beekeeper that we rented out the bees. And he also had a, you know, honey extractor in the garage, and we would sell the honey when we get him back at the end of the season. And he would also do a little bit of, you know, kind of labor, like he had the truck, right? So he's like, if we need to haul stuff or whatever, you know, aluminum buildings or whatever, pallets of anything, right? He was very, a lot of ideas and opportunistic. Yeah. And so I just think about like who I am today, and I'm the same way, you know, and certainly in different areas, but I just think about like, you know, witnessing that and observing that all those years, how grateful I was. And so, you know, this is Foster Care Awareness Month. Now, mm-hmm. you know, any given day, there's like 12 or 15, like, you know, National Ice Cream Day or Asparagus sure. Day or whatever. Right. So, but to me, that what inspires me is I know of a lot of people, and I have friends who are, you know, who are foster kids. So I'll you know, I think, you know, I want to call out a few of them and see if they tell me that I was in it. Right? So Dan and Mel, you guys are amazing. And, Rebecca, you guys are amazing. And, you know, Tommy and Robin taking foster kids kind of after your kids have moved out. It's amazing. You know, Lenora and Fred, you guys were amazing. So it's just everybody out there who is doing anything related to helping foster kids. You don't have to take them into your house, right? Like there's babysitting and meals and activities and camps like you're talking about. And mm-hmm. there's so many things that we can do to help. And so that's what inspires me, is there's all these people just quietly transforming lives out there, just like they transform mine. And just want to, you know, do whatever I can to support those that are in kind of my orbit, and just encourage others to think about it, especially here in Los Angeles. We're the biggest market for foster care in the country. Really? You know, estimates are anywhere from 35 to 45,000 kids at any given time, just in LA County. Mm-hmm. And so that's a lot of people giving their lives, right, for a lot of challenging cases, knowing that, you know what, this kid might be taken from me tomorrow, but I'm going to love him today. And boy, that's wonderful.
That's amazing. It would be great if you could drop some show notes, or I think you've got a website that might be related to this. But whatever introductory resources there are to helping with foster care, whether you actually are coming into contact one-on-one with the kids, or what the other options are, because when you just said, you know, you don't have to get into your house, I was like, really? I thought that was foster care. Hmm. So if there's more than that, like it might be a nice to have a gentle on-ramp for people that they could learn about to do that. So
I love it.
That's just an off the cuff thought.
But yes, I'll include it in the show notes. I do have a small nonprofit related to basically doing what my foster dad did with me and a couple other mentors, is they took a foster kid and they helped him become a founder kid.
Cool. Right?
And so founderkids.org is that organization. But I'll put more notes, because I think it's a great point to create an article of like, you know, here's the 20 things you can do. Only one totally. Of which is take a kid into your house.
Yeah. What's right? the terminology we should Google? I mean, I met a woman on a plane one time who'd fostered 37 children.
That's
she was
amazing.
Probably in her 50s. I don't know all the details, but I just thought, wow. And I'm worried about getting a cat.
Right.
You know? This
right.
woman is just dealing with, she can roll with it, you know. I was just amazing to meet somebody like that. So
yeah,
that's a good one.
It's good. I mean, I'll give you my foster parents were an example of that. I mean, they would essentially, if they knew a parent was like gonna go party on the weekends and have their kids sleep in the car, they would say, look, just drop them off at our house.
Yeah
You know, don't put them through that. So it's an amazing thing. Very good. Well, another great episode.
And all right. Well, good talking to you as always.
Indeed, as always. And be careful about changing those field data types for sure.
Yes, I'm going to lose sleep over that one.
One silver lining to the current times is the ability to attend great online events that would otherwise be missed because they're not in your local area. A great example is Send Cal Dreamin', coming up Tuesday, June 22nd and the 23rd from 9 to noon. It's not the full day, just the mornings on both days. Join me and other great speakers helping make the most of your Salesforce investment. It will cost only your valuable time and attention. More details at johnklein.com/CCD.